Countdown for blast off. X minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X minus 1, fire.
Another episode of the Forgot My Dice podcast. Welcome to episode 5, in fact. And this is Jonathan Edwards, your moderator, and with me always, Mr. Robert Lunger. How you doing?
I'm gonna shake it up. Ahoy, ahoy.
I don't even know how to respond to that.
That is how Monty Burns answers the phone. And to explain the joke and make it more unfunny, the reason he said that is because when the telephone was invented, that is how, oh God, I'm blanking right now, twin brain, Edison, right? Thomas Edison? There yeah. We go. That is how he thought we should answer the phone, because hello he thought was too cold and impersonal, but ahoy, ahoy was a superior greeting.
Well, shiver me timbers.
And that is why Monty says it, Monty Burns, because it shows how old he is.
And for more humor on the 1800s, please come to ForgotMyDice.com.
Yes, where we have all of your old-timey humor. Puns. Puns were a big thing back in the day.
It's like an entire century of nothing but dad jokes. Well, without further ado, Robert.
Without further ado, you had a big weekend. That belongs up top, not off the shelf, but like up top in announcing and stuff.
Yes. So I did spend the last weekend in an interesting way. I got married to my fiance, as opposed to somebody else, I suppose. Yeah, it was fantastic. It was a beautiful ceremony. Robert and Gina managed to ditch the twins long enough to come and spend the evening as well.
Yeah, we foolishly invited some friends over, and while they were eating tacos, we kind of casually left the building. It was pretty cool. It's nice how that worked out.
How did they do with the twins?
Awful. Our twins hate everybody but us.
That's fair.
Barry, as it is, barely tolerates me, and well, Miles is Miles. He just hates, and you just have to learn how to work through his hate.
Let
Which I failed at today,
because
he was supposed to be in here with me right now, but I couldn't get through his hate, so aww. He's downstairs with Mom.
He dropped off the little hate bomb on Mom.
Yeah, some hate bombs. But congratulations, bravo, you got married.
Oh, thank you. That was the easy part. Now the hard part's going to be for her, really, and that's going to be existing with me.
Yeah. Well, here's a word to the wise. It was a fairly casual wedding, which was real nice. I wore sneakers, which made it easier to dance.
You're welcome. Yes, it was a very casual wedding on purpose. Neither of us wanted anything fancy, and I think it really just kind of made everybody just that much more relaxed.
Jonathan got married. Huzzah. All right.
Thank you.
Moving on.
So let's go ahead and move on to our off-the-shelf section. This is, of course, the section of the show where we talk about everything we've gotten off of our shelf and onto our tables. Robert, both of us, me because of wedding and you because of babies, have rather short lists this time. So you want to kick us off?
So I got into board games a little later than it seems everybody did. So I actually didn't ever say play Settlers of Catan for 3 years after I started playing board games. Because every time I'm like, hey, guys, let's play some Settlers of Catan, everybody's like, ah, oh, not that again. I played that too much. So along the same lines, I finally knocked off one of those classic board games that I've never played for some reason, even though I played like Lords of Waterdeep and Zombicide and all that. And I managed to play some Ticket to Ride. How awesome is that?
And how did you like it?
It's really good. We had a lot of fun. Gina and I bought the app, which was nice because we could kind of put it down, and we did for a bit, actually, one day. But yeah, we've been playing it off and on since we got the bright idea to try it out, because it had been on our iPads for, I don't know, like 2 months at this point, a while.
It's addictive. That app in particular really captures everything that it needs to about the game. It's a really good app.
Yeah, I really do want to play with the little teeny tiny trading cards. And I kind of am sad that I did not end up getting the 10th anniversary edition with the big board and the little plastic trains.
I regularly eyeball that at one of our local stores. And I already have a copy of it, and it's fully functional. And it works great. And it's not like it adds anything to it but bling. But I'm feeling the call of the bling.
Yeah, the bling is nice.
All right. Any other board games make it on the table for you?
No, although, you know what? I think I forgot to talk about Robot Turtles when I actually played it. Did I talk about Robot Turtles?
Mm-mm.
Oh, okay. So I got Robot Turtles out, too, with my 5-year-old. And it was a game that was on Kickstarter, and I think they're selling it at Target now from what I'm seeing. But it kind of reminded me of sort of Robo Rally Lite. You make a little maze, and you have your robot turtle, and you play cards, and, you know, the turtle has to follow the commands that are on the cards, and it works its way through the maze to get to the gem, and everybody wins. Hooray!
And so it's program movement?
Yeah. But it's a program movement game designed for kids, and they have a lot of different components. So they have ice walls, and they have rock walls. And, you know, you can get a laser that will melt the ice walls, but it doesn't melt the rock walls, and yada, yada, yada. But you can, you know, you can introduce these things as you go on. And so, yeah, my kid and I, we've been playing it off and on, actually, since just after the twins were born. So, yeah, it was definitely while this podcast was on. Nice. And, yeah, I have completely forgotten to talk about it, usually because we end up playing it right after we record the podcast, and then, like, 2 weeks goes by between recordings. And then I forgot about it because, you know, the stuff that happens just after we record kind of slips my brain. Robot Turtles, I think it's available at just Target now. I was on the website. It's available somewhere. It's not just a Kickstarter exclusive thing anymore. It's a nice little game for kids. I recommend it. It was fun.
Awesome. Well, I too played a program movement game. I had a chance to try out Dragon and Flagon, the new one from Stronghold Games.
I like the title.
Oh, it's awesome. So basically the concept is all of the heroes of the realm have come to this pub because there's only one flagon of this, like, spectacular hero juice left, and everybody wants it, and it erupts into a barroom brawl.
Is the hero juice made out of actual heroes?
I don't know. I haven't read that deeply into the fluff yet. Now from 100% organically raised heroes.
You know it's adventurers because you can just get the murder hobo. It's the aftertaste.
So in the game, you've got this big giant pub, and it's really kind of neat because all of the components of the game are pieces of the pub. So there's chairs and barrels and tables and rugs, and it's a program movement game, and you program out all of your movements and then just kind of like watch the action unfold, and you can literally pull the rug out from underneath other characters, causing them to fall. And if you fall, of course, it makes your program movements disappear. You can kick a barrel across the bar at other people, and it knocks over everybody in its path. And I mean, it's just pure chaos. It's just as chaotic as a barroom brawl should be, except in board game form. And it totally works, and it's totally fun. And it's one of those games that at the end, everybody starts talking about their experiences during the fight. And that's kind of like where it really hits on its magic.
Do you own this game?
I do indeed.
We should play it, because I don't know if you know this about me, but I have some bizarre secret love of Robo Rally, and I don't play that game enough, and this is like rubbing that Robo Rally itch in me.
Oh, I will put this out on the table anytime. It's got awesome components, it's super, super fun, and it's completely silly and ridiculous.
Does it have the patent-pending FMD baby? What is it? Where is it on the baby scale? Baby in a crib? Baby in a carrier? Baby in the front pack?
Oh, total baby in the front pack. You can totally.
Oh, thank God.
Yeah, you can make this work. It's super fun. And then I had an opportunity to play Camel Up with the kids, which is always a fun one.
Jelly. I love Camel Up.
As it turns out, my 9-year-old bets with reckless abandon and does not care about running out of money. The 7-year-old is extremely conservative, and I'm convinced that she may in fact be a card shark. I apparently have no ability to beat my children anymore. That is now gone. So I cannot beat Chloe. It's ridiculous. She's the perfect mix of methodical and careful. That, and I'm pretty sure she wants to stab me in my sleep, but that's a different story for a different day.
No, that's just having children.
Yeah. Then I also had a chance to teach Burger Up to a visiting friend who was out for the wedding. We had an opportunity to battle it out as we constructed burgers. I handily destroyed him this time, but I suspect next time that he may cook me into a corner because he was picking it up pretty quick there at the end. He was making some good combos.
Is this game of Burger Up that we tweeted out the other day on the 21st?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And they actually have another Kickstarter out right now that looks awesome, and I backed that one, Skyward.
Yeah, go and back Skyward. Oh, you can't, because by the time this comes out, it'll be over.
Wah, wah, wah. In other news that you would have been able to guess at any time, Seven Wonders Duel, I continue to lose ruthlessly to Jessica. I don't understand it, and I regret teaching her the game.
Just accept your failure, sir. You just got married.
I mean, you know, let the Wookiee win, right?
Wow.
That better get cut.
I'm going to call dibs on the first part of this podcast, and I'm going to edit it, and that's going to skip, and I'm going to play it for her, and I'm going to get you in trouble.
Oh, look at that. We've had a recording error. That's unfortunate. We better restart. Finally, I haven't had a chance to get this out on the table yet, but I have cracked the rule book and smelled the box ruthlessly. I managed to get my hands on a copy of Star Trek Ascendancy. Just the briefest of brief read-throughs of the rules. It's everything that you love about a 4X in a very streamlined way, and everything just seems to capture that flavor of the show, which is something that every Star Trek game up to now has done miserably.
I need to play that game.
It's kind of odd. It's a really expensive game. It's $100 for the box if you pay MSRP. I mean, you get a lot in there, but it's only three players out of the box. You actually have to spend $30 for one additional race, of which they're releasing two by the end of the year. They're releasing the Cardassians and the Ferengi. And in the box, you get the Romulans, the Klingons, and the humans.
It adds players, so you can play a four-player game after that point, right?
And a five-player if you have the last race.
Rad.
So it's three players if you have the base. And then by the end of the year, there should be those two expansions out, bringing you up to four or five players, depending on what you get. Now, it's just the components are really nice from what I've seen so far. It's got a really nice insert. I really like the way they handle the game. And one of the ways that they handle the duration of the game is that you can space your starting planets differently. And that determines how you start exploring the table. So the further apart they are, the more exploration there is before you run into each other.
Nifty.
And so, you know, you could I could easily see this game basically taking an entire day, especially if you were playing with five players. There's a lot of crunch in the rules that I'm still kind of trying to digest. But I think one or two plays and you're going to have everything kind of nice and streamlined. And I see this as one of those games that you get a group of like-minded folks and it's just you keep coming back to it. It just seems awesome. I cannot wait to get my first play in.
Well, like-minded folks, Gina and I named our kid Miles Bryan because of a character in Star Trek. So
hey, look at that. One, two, three.
Yeah, yeah.
You need to order another front pack?
No, Gina's got one of those wrap things. I just hate it because you got to like tie it onto yourself. Yeah, so she's got that down.
All right, then let's do this. Yeah, that's about it for board games, other than I had an opportunity to sit down and create my Pathfinder character for an upcoming campaign a friend of mine's running.
Oh, nice. And you got told not to be a summoner because summoners are busted.
Yeah, well, as it turns out, he was aware of how busted summoners were, and he said no to it. So I rolled up a witch instead.
Oh, fun. Very appropriate, because you're playing Carrion Crown.
Yes.
Which is their vaguely Ravenloft area.
Yeah, and we're doing it in honor of Halloween. We're starting the campaign here in mid-October. It looks awesome. I mean, I still find 3.5 to be a bit on the crunchy side, and that's okay. It is what it is. I'm not holding it against it. I do like the Witch class. Everything I've read about it so far is pretty neat. You can spec it a lot of different ways, which is neat. And I have a familiar, and it's a bat, and its name is Frederick. So there's that.
Well, okay, so since you're playing Carrion Crown, which means you're going to go monster hunting, which breed of monster hunter are you? Are you Sam Winchester or Dean Winchester?
Definitely a Sam Winchester.
Ah, oh, really? Well, every party needs the guy who does something stupid to make the plot progress.
It's not my character's fault. He was rolled that way. How about other geeky stuff? Have you had any video games out?
Yeah. I've been getting stuff in. I've been playing Overwatch off and on, obviously, trying to get some Halloween loot boxes, but my video game soul has been sucked into Dragon Quest Builders for the last 2 weeks. I have been playing that.
Yeah, it's all you're talking about.
Yeah, I've been playing it a lot. It is right up my alley because I've played Minecraft. I own it and I like it. But every so often, you know, you just get bored building stuff. And it's like, I wish I could, you know, stop building stuff and go do something. And the stuff that you go do in Minecraft, you know, it's all randomly generated. There is like a progression in that game, but like just kind of you have to go out and find it. And there's not really like a story per se. There's one if you make it up in your own head, because I guess there kind of is one. But anyway, the story in Dragon Quest Builders, while not like it's not Game of Thrones, it is. There is a story there. There is a narrative.
Everybody dies.
No, very few people die. But if I get tired of building, you know, I can be like, I am tired of building. I want to go do something. And that's when I realize I've got like this backlog of, you know, quests I can go do. It's like, go and find. Oh, like I had to go track down this book, which is there's this ruined kingdom and they were really good at farming and they had the Farmer Sutra there. And I'm like, oh, God, Dragon Quest Builders. Really?
That's awesome.
Yeah. And it taught me how to grow corn, and I'm like, this is awesome.
Did it show you all the positions you should farm it?
It shows you all the ways. Yes, yeah, all the ways you farm stuff. It's pretty fun. So, but yeah, I mean, the game's just fun like that. You I get on these bizarre kicks where I'm like, you know, I'm just looking. I'm like, I want my base to be a castle. And then I go build this gigantic castle. And then monsters invade my castle. And I'm like, I am tired of fighting off monsters when I'd rather be building. And then I realized I can make, like, spike traps. And so I surround my castle with spike traps 4 layers deep, which requires me to farm an absurd amount of resources. And I just did it. And I got really into it and all crazy about it. And then after I got done with that, I'm like, oh, man, I just farmed up all these resources for spikes. I'll just go do quests. And it was awesome. And yeah, it's just it's a really nice game. It threads this really nice needle where if you get bored of doing the one thing, you can just go do the other and it works well. And the sense of humor in that game is really funny. I tweeted out a picture of the last character you encounter in Chapter 1, who is a... You know, in Dragon Quest, how they have those stupid little slimes that are like the intro enemy ever? You know, little blue guy with a happy face?
Yeah.
You find one, and he's like, all the other slimes pick on me because I don't hate humans. Will you be my friend? And I'm like, sure, I'll be your friend. And then, like, all these slimes, like, attack him and try to kill him, and I fended them all off. He's like, I can't stay here anymore. Can I go live with you? And I'm like, sure, I'll have a little slime buddy. Why not? And his name turns out to be Splattrick. And anytime he talks, if he says anything that vaguely has like a guh sound, like go or going, he says like gooing in the text. So it's like, I'm gooing over here.
So and then found the punny slime.
Yeah. And and ooze. Ooze comes into his conversation. It's like, there's a lot of ooze ditching people in this town. And I'm like, yes, there are, Splattrick. You're amazing. And it's just, the game is so random in its sense of humor. And you're like, what are you? Farmer Sutra, really? Okay. So yeah, no, it's just a stupid amount of fun. I've been having a good time. I built a crazy castle, and then I got dropped into a poisonous swamp for the second part of the game, which kind of sucks because they revert a lot of your progress, which I was kind of mad at first, but then it gave me an excuse to build a whole bunch of new stuff, and it forced me to build with different things, so I kind of got into that. And in the second place, you have a lot of wood that you can work with, so I was like, I'll build the Psycho House because it's Halloween. It only kind of looks like the Psycho House, but I don't care.
Well, I, too, have had an opportunity to pick up a controller in the last couple of weeks, and I've played some Mafia 3. It's a decent open-world game with a really interesting and well-acted story, so I'm having a really good time with it so far. You know, every time I start to get a little frustrated or upset at the control scheme, I get another cutscene, and it's like, okay, everything is forgiven. Yeah, the whole story takes place in post-Vietnam, 60s Louisiana. And the main character is African-American, meaning that he kind of encounters a whole mess of problems just because he is who he is. And it's just, it's interesting. They handle it very well. The writing is exceptional, and the acting is second to none. It's one of the best acted video games I've ever seen. And it's just, I'm having a great, great time with it. And what the best part is that the main character isn't like a mafioso, and it's not a cookie-cutter mafia story. Instead, you've got this very complicated and conflicted veteran who's, you know, equal parts PTSD and victim of the 60s culture in the South. And it just forms into a genuinely interesting narrative.
I may have to pick that up. That sounds fun.
Yeah, it's pretty phenomenal. And then Battlefield 1 came out, and I find myself absolutely enthralled with it. I think as far as Battlefield games go, I think this is by far the most balanced and most interesting take on the genre. And I never would have expected World War One to be quite such an engaging playground for this sort of mayhem. It is completely coming together, and it gels well, and the game modes are fun, and everything just feels great, and it's just a blast.
And you don't see World War One often, which is kind of cool.
No, it's odd because we're going further back in history, and yet it feels fresh, if that makes sense.
Well, it's a lot of untouched territory because,
really,
yeah, nobody touches World War One. Like the Wonder Woman movie deciding they didn't want to be Captain America, so they're like, oh, we'll go back in time to World War One. Actually opened up a lot of possibilities for that movie that didn't exist by making it, you know, a World War II movie with all those tropes.
This Battlefield game has a super interesting start to the campaign. It's, without giving any spoilers away, because they basically tell you in the intro text, it's a battle that you cannot win. Mm. And it's a tiny little section of battle where your character tries to survive as long as he can and eventually dies. And then the whole thing just kind of pauses for a moment, zooms out to an aerial view, and then zooms right back into a different character while giving you a lifespan for the character that just died. And
it literally is life flashing before his eyes.
Pretty much. And it's kind of interesting.
That's dark.
Because, you know, every character is given this little vignette and is given depth and is interesting. And you're like, oh, I wonder where they're going to take this guy. And then he's dead. And it just shows just like the wanton loss of life in this conflict and how it just didn't care who it was. It was just like, it didn't care about background. It didn't care about what they were, who they were, color of the skin or anything. It was just like, you're there one moment, you're gone the next.
That's dark.
Yeah, like- it's a brutal first level. And I think it's kind of interesting. This is the first time that I've played a game set in a war where I'm really kind of just like weighing, hey, you know, what is really the impact of war on a populace? And it made me think, and I'm not used to doing that with a first person shooter.
The game's deep, man.
Yeah, it was surprisingly deep, especially for DICE. They're not exactly known for their moving storylines.
Nice.
Known for plot. Yeah, it was refreshing. That's every aspect of this game as I play it. That's the word that keeps coming up. It's refreshing. That's about it for video games. How about movies, books, assorted geekiness?
When I was a kid, actually, I still am. I'm a huge fan of Godzilla. I love giant monster movies. They're the best. What was known out here in the States as Godzilla 1985 was a slightly recut version of a movie, I think, in Japan that was just called Godzilla, although out here it's called The Return of Godzilla and or Godzilla 1984, because why have one name for a movie when you could have three? Am I right? Or four, I guess, technically. So, but the original Japanese cut has never hadn't been released in America forever, and they just released it on Blu-ray. And I realized I'd heard it was coming out, but I didn't know it had come out. And then I kind of thought to myself, is this out yet? And it was, and I immediately ordered it. Yeah, no, it was kind of fun. It was fun to watch the sort of original storyline, which was they kind of tried to mix in this like Cold War thriller into Godzilla, which was kind of interesting. And I had a good time watching the original cut of this movie. It was a lot of fun. And it made me kind of, you know, reminisce about my youth. And I started going, I need to watch some more giant monster movies. And I realized I had the Gamera trilogy that I also had not watched yet. I just bought it on Blu-ray. So I popped that in and started watching it. And I love that giant turtle. He's so cool.
Nice. Well, I ended up watching a slightly exaggerated giant monster movie. Well, at least for a portion of it as well. I watched Independence Day Resurgence.
Oh, my.
Okay, let me go ahead and preface this. Do not sit down to watch this movie if you're planning on having any kind of conscious thought. Because if you think, even for a moment, even for just a brief second, if you allow yourself to contemplate what you're watching, the whole thing will fall apart. It's terrible. It was awesome. It was super fun. But mind you, it's terrible. It's really bad.
Spoiler alert, I guess we won't go into it, but I read about what the aliens' plot was, and I'm like, you know, if they got any amount of the way through their evil plan, it would destroy the Earth. And I hear they got pretty far in the movie. They talk about it. And it was like, that would have destroyed the Earth.
There's just these moments of just sheer madness is all I can tell you. So, you know, the moon, it's a very large object. The Earth, an even larger object. Both of these things generate a little funny thing called a gravitational field, right?
Yeah.
They have like these ships that they show breaking atmo all the time. They go all the way down to Earth. They pick up some dudes, and then they go all the way back up to space so they can go to the moon, right? Then the giant alien ship comes, and they're commenting on how it has a gravitational field, and somehow the ship that was able to break Earth's gravity and get up to space is helpless in the gravitational field of this ship small enough to land on Earth. I can't even wrap my head around how somebody wasn't just looking down at the paper and going, hey guys, mass is a thing? God, it's so stupid. But the whole time I was grinning because it's got, you know, cheesy special effects and cities are getting destroyed and there's explosions and dogfighting and you're going to lose a couple of IQ points. This is like taking a toke off of the helium balloon. You know you're killing brain cells, but you're kind of okay with it because it's funny. I also had a chance to watch X-Men Apocalypse.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, there's moments. I think I'm most disappointed because it comes after the brilliant Days of Future Past. So you get two X-Men movies in a row. You get First Class and Days of Future Past. They both handle very large, very diverse casts effectively. They give everybody just the right amount of screen time to connect the story and make things move, right? Somehow, even though it's the same team of people making it, it's like they forgot how to do that. The movie meanders. It's got slow spots. It's got a villain who we never fully understand his motivations. It's got some questionable special effects that look so obviously filmed in front of a green screen that it feels like we're back in like 2001 again. I mean, it's just like, it's a head scratcher. How do you go from Days of Future Past to this? It's like completely ignoring your previous body of work and saying, you know, I'm going to try all these things again, brand new. Like, you know, like it's 15 years ago because I want to be retro.
So safe to say you did not like it.
It's mediocre. There's pieces of it that work and there's pieces of it that don't. The biggest problem is that they did not take all the pieces that work and stitch them together in an effective way. You can have a couple of weak spots in a movie and make it work. But the problem is that for every highlight, it's bogged down by these humongous troughs of boredom where nothing progresses.
I think the moral of the story is you should have watched Gamera, Guardian of the Universe instead, because that movie is awesome. It's got a giant walking turtle
fighting
birds. Next
time you come
over,
please bring it and I shall watch it. So two shorter lists, but certainly we did manage to get a few things on the table. So let's see how the next 2 weeks fare. I don't know about you, Robert, but my list of things to do has substantially diminished now that the wedding's over. So I should be able to get back to our normally scheduled gaming.
A lot of my time got tied up because my parents were in town to meet the twins. So, but they are gone now. So it is back to the regularly scheduled insanity over here.
Do you have a tabletop, board game, miniature game, or RPG that you're going to release for retail?
Or do you have an upcoming tabletop Kickstarter that you're about to launch?
We would love to interview you for a future episode of the Forgot My Dice podcast.
Send us an email to fmdpodcast2016@gmail.com to schedule an interview. Now, as always, we turn our attention to the wisdom of crowds, our news and crowdfunding corner. So let's start off with yet another expansion on a game that I really, truly enjoy playing, but I don't know how they're going to make this work. And Robert, that is Gloom in Space! I mean, look, don't get me wrong. I absolutely adore Gloom. I think it's a great little game. It's got these fantastic little see-through cards, and the object is to basically stack cards on one another and create the gloomiest person until you figure out a way to murder them and cash their points in. How are you going to do that in space?
Do you think that those cats in the movie Aliens were having a good time? You know, like, that's how you do it.
I suppose, but I mean, Gloom's always had this certain tongue-in-cheek nature to it. I just don't know how it's going to translate.
Also, the art on the front of the box is not something I'd expect. There's like a weird space farmer and somebody running from a drone. It's strange.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the cover art too, and it just doesn't, it doesn't even feel like Gloom. I mean, this feels so tacked on, and of course I will reserve judgment until I've had an opportunity to sit down and play it, but one of the draws for Gloom for me has always been the art. I mean, it just matches with the tongue-in-cheek nature of the cards so well, and I look at this one, it just couldn't possibly be more generic.
In my mind, I went straight to, like, you know, the space horror movies like Aliens and whatnot. And then the cover art is not talking to me about aliens. It's this weird, like, sort of 1970s retro kind of art style. Yeah. I'm not sure.
Maybe there'll be a lot of references to Disney's Black Hole.
That's actually a fairly gloomy movie, too.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it really is.
Spoiler alert, if you don't know what it meant when they fell into the black hole, they literally went to heaven. Those were angels leading them out of there. And the other dude went to hell. That is what's on the other side of the black hole, heaven and hell.
Good times.
Yeah, good times.
Spoiler alert for the 40-year-old movie. Moving on, if there's one thing that's iconic within the board game and RPG industry, that is the concept of the convention. And we're getting a new convention, and that is the HasCon. And this is a convention from Hasbro, the toy company.
It's going to be in Rhode Island near their corporate headquarters. It's going to be at the Dunkin' Donuts Convention Center, September 8th through the 10th in 2017. And basically, it's
going to
America
runs on Dunkin'.
Yeah, basically, it's going to be like BlizzCon, but for Hasbro properties. So they're taking their big money makers. So the list of included properties thus far is kind of strange. And they're going to have like convention exclusives. And some of them are like, oh, I could see a convention exclusive, but some of them I don't see it. But whatever, we'll find out. So the list is Transformers, My Little Pony, Littlest Pet Shop, which I would have never heard of until my daughter became obsessed with them the other day. Magic the Gathering, Nerf, Monopoly, and G.I. Joe. It's a weird mix. I don't know how they're going to make a cohesive thing about it. I mean, I guess it's all under the Hasbro umbrella, so who knows? One thing that's not on the list right now is Dungeons & Dragons, and it's probably because while Dungeons & Dragons does really well for role-playing games, that is not anywhere near My Little Pony or Magic Money. But Warner Brothers is going to make a Dungeons & Dragons movie, and I think they're starting to film next year, if I remember correctly. I'm not sure, but we're going to get it sooner or later, and if the movie makes a ton of money, maybe Hasbro, HasCon 2, we will see D&D take up a place in the top money earners for Hasbro.
Yeah, it does seem like a good fit.
Yeah, or something. I don't know. It's like, are they going to run Magic events next to, you know, Nerf Wars, next to Transformers talk? I don't know. It's a bizarre thing. Like, at least with, like, Blizzard, with BlizzCon, you know, everybody's playing video games, even if they're wildly different. This is completely crazily different toy properties. So I'm not sure how they're going to make a cohesive con out of it. I'm going to keep following it, though, because I want to know if they're going to pull it off or not.
And I'm going to keep hoping that a really good hobby-level Transformers game is eventually made. Well, sticking with Hasbro and their subsidiary, Wizards of the Coast, we are getting a new Dungeons & Dragons book soon.
Vola's Guide to Monsters is coming out very soon, and I can't wait. I think we talked about it in 05, or the Half-Cast, one of our pilot episodes. It's imminent. It releases late October, early November, depending on if you're a preferred retailer. But they've been releasing a lot of spoilers for it, you know, like pictures of the book, and they released the entire Fearbulg race, which I love Fearbulg Giants. They're my favorite thing ever, and I don't know why.
And for the completionist in you, there's actually a pretty good reason to go to your friendly local gaming store and get it. They get it 11 days early, and they're getting a special limited edition cover.
And actually, I don't know if you noticed this, but on the standard issue cover, they have a picture of Volo, and he has a book in his hand, and the book in his hand is the special edition hardcover.
Nice. Well done.
Full circle.
Well played. Lots of good stuff in this book, too. 96 new monsters, 3 new player races, the Firbolg, the Goblin, and the Orc. And over 100 pages of fluff around the different monsters.
So the lead designer of D&D has been on the internet's talking about it, and he is kind of saying this is what he thinks a post Game of Thrones D&D book looks like. So I don't know. I mean, 100 pages of fluff, it looks pretty cool. And a lot of the new monsters, like they showed some pages of the Mind Flayer one, and Mind Flayers apparently come in little larvae. And so one of the new monsters is obviously Mind Flayer larva, and that's just mixed into the section on Mind Flayers. So it looks fun. It looks cool. I can't wait for this book.
It does look good. It looks genuinely good. It looks like an essential piece of kit for any DM.
So next up, something from War Machine World. So I noticed this when I was looking at the press release for Shadow Games, Steamforge's card game based in the Guild Ball universe, that DC Carl had done some work on it. And I knew he had left Privateer Press to do basically freelance stuff, but they released a press release saying that DC Carl, the former lead developer of War Machine, has now moved over to Steamforge Games and has taken basically the same position for them. So he is the lead designer of all things Steamforge, from their card games and board games all the way up to Guild Ball.
Nice. That's going to be an interesting fit, because Guild Ball's, it's definitely found a following in the U.S.,
Yeah. I've wanted to play it. I just never. It's one of those things. There's always a few people around who play it, but they are never in the same place at the same time.
But I mean, it's kind of interesting, because I know a lot of people that have bought into Guild Ball, and this is very unlike them, because these are folks that generally only have one miniatures game going at any given time. And for whatever reason, Guild Ball seems to be striking a chord with a lot of people.
I'm very curious about it. So
as am I.
Honestly, this guy going to work for them is a good thing. DC had a advanced math degree, and he was making bank, and enough bank that he just basically retired early. And he's like, what am I going to do with my retirement? I'm just going to go make games, because why not? Because I can. Every so often, he would write blog posts about mathing War Machine, and sometimes he'd go way out into the mathematical weeds and start talking about statistical models with really weird variables, and you're like, whoa, this guy's playing on a level that I could kind of like look at and not even get. So him going to Steamforge Games is a good sign for that game, because it means he's pretty good about getting things in order there and giving...
I think that's something that Guild Ball needs, because if there's something I've noticed is that there's been a lot of flux with the rules. They're already on a third variant of the rules. They've been masking them as seasons, and they've been adding a little bit to the rule set with every season as they introduce new models. But they've also been using the seasons as an opportunity to do large-scale changes or errata. And honestly, I think a little bit of tightening would go a long way.
No, he's pretty good at that. I mean, under his watch was the majority of Mark II, and I know he had a lot to do with Mark III of War Machine. So, and problems aside with the release, which we talked about when we reviewed it, Mark III War Machine is a very cleaned up rule set, so good times with him. And I didn't know if you know this, he was out here for WarGamesCon 1 year, and I got a call from a buddy, and he's like, we're going out to Brazilian barbecue with the Privateer guys, do you want to come with? And I'm like, yeah.
Nice. And how good is Brazilian barbecue, by the way? Just it's a amazing side note there.
So good. Oh.
What's that? I sit down in a chair and people bring me meat until I get the meat sweats. Okay. And finally, in the news front, another piece of news from FFG that's going to kind of tie into our discussion topic tonight. And that is Mansions of Madness is getting its first expansion. Now, of course, this is an expansion for the newly released second edition, which technically already has two expansions sitting on the shelf, of course. But those two are basically components from the first edition of the game put out for folks that are buying the second edition so they can bring all those models and characters into the second edition. This, on the other hand, is a brand new expansion, the first true addition to the Mansions of Madness universe.
And I've noticed it's got Fantasy Flight's bang up release date system of early next year.
Is it on the boat? Is it Maybe. Coming soon? We Is don't know. We'll find out.
Yeah, we'll find out. They're the biggest company I know of that doesn't have firm release dates. It's really irritating.
Yeah, that's a whole nother discussion topic. A couple of good things on here. A couple new scenarios. A couple of new investigators. And most importantly for any Mansions of Madness game, another new monster. So if you want to take a peek, Fantasy Flight Games website, of course, has some information. We'll post a link to it in the show notes so that you can go take a peek at the new monster.
It's a lady with a big hand.
Yeah, it's kind of very Resident Evil-ish. So that completes the news for today's episode. So now let's go into the crowdfunding arena and take a look at what's on Kickstarter, which is still, to be fair, a little dry.
And if you haven't heard of this one, shame on you. It's the Oatmeal. But yeah, Oatmeal, famous makers of Exploding Kittens, have a new game up called Bears vs. Babies. And everything you need to know about what the game is about is in that title.
Yeah, it's another card game. And let me just preface this. Exploding Kittens. If you're a fan of the Oatmeal, you're going to love this game. If you're not, you're probably going to look at this game and wonder why it's so simple. I don't think we're going to get anything different with Bears versus Babies. If you like the Oatmeal, you're going to think this game is hysterical and awesome and lovely. If you don't, chances are you're going to miss the point and maybe this isn't for you. But apparently it's for a lot of people as they've already brought in almost $1.5 million.
KickTrack is saying it's going to make an epic ton of money. Yeah, I like how they're in their middle zone, you know, where a lot of the Kickstarters I track are like, oh, we made like $100 today in our long middle. Yeah, their bad day, which was yesterday, apparently, they made $29,000.
That is ridiculous.
Yeah, this is going to make all the money ever.
Well, I mean, I have Exploding Kittens, and I can tell you, if we strip away the theme, if we strip away the Oatmeal from it, we have a relatively simplistic push-your-luck card game. But honestly, that the art and the sense of humor really makes the game, and it makes it fun, and I laugh every single time I play it. I always have a good time. So I am looking forward to it, not necessarily for the gameplay, but certainly for the Oatmeal's take on things.
We don't know much about the next one. It is No Thank You Evil from Monte Cook Games is going to have an adventure expansion, and that is literally all we know about it, because it's going to launch on the 26th of this month, which is a few days from now. And so it's in that nice little weird zone where if we don't talk about it now, we might not talk about it next time, because it might be too far gone at that point for us to mention.
Yeah, Monte Cook Games tends to run shorter Kickstarter campaigns.
Invisible Sun was only like, what, 15 days?
Yeah, and look at how that did.
We're mentioning it now just in case they don't run a 30-day Kickstarter, because we might not have time to cover it next time. So
now this runs off of the Cypher system, right? But it's a stripped version of it.
Yeah, it uses a D6 instead of a D20, and if you're familiar with the Cypher system, there are 10 levels of difficulty in that, and this one only has 8. But other than that, it's spin points, try to roll high, that type of stuff.
So it takes a lot of the complexity out and makes it appropriate for starting RPG players or children, yeah?
Yeah, I have been looking for a entry-level RPG for my kids ever since I had them, and I've gotten my hands on quite a few things, and I think, honestly, this one's the best one. So if you're looking for an RPG for your kids, like, check it out and check out this Kickstarter, because more adventures means more stuff you don't have to make up on the fly for your kids.
Now next up is Dark Skies 1942, and this is something I threw on the list because it pretty much tickles everything that I need out of a game. It has airplanes in it, it has alternate history from World War II, it has a dieselpunk theme, and even a touch of Cthulhu. So it kind of tickled me in every single way. It's a 15mm aerial combat game. Think X-Wing, except that the rule set is a little more complex and has some very interesting additions to it.
Sorry, this is the first time I have seen this Kickstarter, and it's got models in it, and I'm like, ah, models!
And now you know why I added it. It's kind of weird because, yes, it's a diesel punk alternate history 1942, and it's kind of riffing off of the actual aircraft from World War II, but definitely taking them in a flying battleship direction, if you will. Because there is a touch of Lovecraft added to it, and I'm not 100% sure how that's being added in, because there's not a complete rule set put up yet. But I can tell you this much, the look of the game is fantastic. It looks gorgeous. One of the neat things that it does to differentiate itself from X-Wing is that it does incorporate the concept of altitude. Each of the models sits upon a resin base, and it has four magnetized sections, so you can basically put your model on 1, 2, 3, or 4 pegs indicating an altitude. And the altitude figures into the rule set, which really is going to add a whole new twist to combat on the tabletop.
So you got this, right?
I'm hovering over the back button.
You should get it. It looks fun.
Yeah, it does look interesting. I really like the art style. I love what they've done with the airplane, so I'm very curious to both see a final rule set for it and to dive into it. I'm having a feeling that my self-control is not going to last on this. Well, let's move into our next game, and our next game is Drawing Dead. And really what catches my eye here is the pedigree of the developer John Fiorillo. And he was the lead developer on a couple of games, one of which is considered one of the greatest deck builders ever released, and that is Ascension.
It's billing itself as a family-friendly card game set in the Wild West, integrating a Mexican Day of the Dead theme. But the game is recommended for 3 to 6 players, but allows for a 2-player mode and can support up to 8 players if you buy a second copy of the game. And the MSRP is pretty reasonable. It's $20.
Yeah, no, it's a great price point for getting into it. Ascension alone is a reason to pick this game up, because Ascension is just a brilliant deck builder.
Next up is another role-playing game called Open Legend and Emuria's Dawn campaign setting.
Now, talk to us a little bit about the Open Legend rule set. Is this a D20 game?
No, it's its own thing. So you can go to the Open Legend website and look at the rule set right now. It is something they created back in February, and it is just an open source, like, here you go, here's a game engine that they are making. And what this Kickstarter is the website is just, it's just a website. It's not even like a PDF or anything. It is just a website of rules. And so what they want to do now is make a cool PDF, obviously, and also release a hardcover book of the rule set, which is their goal. The game basically uses it. It kind of reminds me of Savage Worlds in a weird way, because it's kind of narrative, but you roll a D20, you're trying to roll high. If you do manage to roll 20, you get to roll again and add the result, because the dice explode. And then when you roll the D20, you also roll additional dice based off of your stat. So stats, if you have low stats, you get an extra D4. If you have high stats, you get up to 2D6. So you roll the D20, you roll your extra dice based off of your modifier, and you add all that up. And if you beat the target number, you win, huzzah. And if you don't, then you don't, you lose.
Now, this game's got quite a pedigree, too.
Well, the campaign setting does. If you're curious about it, just go to the website. You can read the rule set right now. It's very fantasy-based right now, even though they say it's a multi-genre rules engine. There is not a lot of love for sci-fi or horror there. It is all fantasy right now. But it's something they're going to work on for the Kickstarter. And then the campaign setting, Emuria's Dawn, is made by Matthew Mercer, who you may know from Critical Role, and Ed Greenwood, who created the Forgotten Realms.
Well, that is, of course, everything that we've got in the news and tabletop crowdfunding section of the show today. As always, we're always looking for tips, so if you know of something that's coming soon, or you know something that you'd like to hear about, please send them to us at fmdpodcast2016@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you and love to incorporate it onto the show. We love getting feedback, so please let us know how we're doing by one of the following.
You can email us at fmdpodcast2016@gmail.com.
You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/forgotmindice. We post all our articles there, so feel free to comment. Or you can message us directly via Facebook Messenger.
We also have a Pinterest page where, among other things, we post our articles along with other cool stuff we find. You can find us and message us there at pinterest.com/forgotmydice.
We also have Facebook comments enabled for all our articles at forgotmydice.com.
You can message us or tweet us on the Twitters. Find us at forgotmydice.
If you like the show, the best way for more people to find out about us is to give us a review on iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher.
Lastly, for those of you listening to us from the Wizarding World, send your owls to forgotmydice.
The Wizarding World?
Yeah, they listen to podcasts on crystal balls.
Okay. And finally, we come to the final segment of our show tonight, and that is going to be a discussion this evening rather than a review. And tonight we're going to be discussing...
Whoa. Deep discussion, because we have deep dives. Yes. Now we have deep discussions.
A deep discussion indeed. And this week's discussion is all going to be centered around my favorite time of the year, and that is Halloween.
Yes, if you're listening to this when it comes out, I think it is actually Halloween when we're going to release this.
Which is awesome, because what better to listen to while you're walking around watching your kids trick-or-treat than us? So let's talk about games that you can play on Halloween and create...
Hold on. I got one thing. I'm going to creep them out. There you go. It's Halloween.
We're going to discuss a couple different things tonight. We're going to discuss some of the things that you can do to make a game night around this time of the year a little more fun and a little more thematic. And then we're also going to look at some titles, both RPGs and board games, that you can toss out on the table and that are appropriate for the holiday and also a ton of fun to play. We've vetted all of these. Either Robert or I or both of us have played them, so we'll have a quick discussion on gameplay as well for each of these. All right, so to get started, let's talk about setting the mood, first of all. Robert, can you think of some things that we can do around your gameplay space to make things a little more fun with these particular types of games?
Can I? Oh my god, I ran Call of Cthulhu forever. So the first thing you got to do is you got to turn down your lights. Create the mood, make it dim. Now, given I'm older now and I can't make it as dim as I used to because I can't read my character sheets anymore. Yeah, it's sad. But as dark as you can get it for your horror adventure, it helps. It helps having darkness around you. Even if you got like that one kitchen light that's just over your table, if the rest of the house is dark and silent, it's awesome. It sets the correct mood. So yeah.
You know, I've actually run a couple games with candlelight before, just enough candles at the table to light up the character sheets, and it's worked fabulously.
Candles are always a nice thing, especially if you can get them in a candelabra. It really sets the mood if you have that candelabra, that gothic-y, especially if you can hold it up occasionally, especially if you have a reason for somebody to hold it up.
Now, you know, oddly enough, one place that I've seen a lot of candelabras that you can pick up really, really cheap are thrift stores and lightweight antique stores.
Yeah, I remember I got one pretty reasonably priced at like a, was it Cost Plus World Market or something? I got fairly cheap there. Looked like an old-timey candelabra. It was awesome.
Now, another thing that comes to mind, Robert, is going...
And it's Halloween. This is what you do if you want this stuff. Go to the store tomorrow. It's all half off.
Well, and another good place to get cheap stuff is the 99-cent store. They've always got tons of stuff that is appropriate for the season. And so, of course, right now you're going to find a ton of Halloween stuff. And it's all super, super, super cheap. My wife actually went to the 99-cent store to decorate for Halloween, and she was able to get a ton. I'm talking a metric ton of stuff between caution tapes and door hangers, spider webs and little skulls and everything, and she spent less than $20 and really just completely redid the house and made it really fun.
So another thing I'd suggest, and this will work for board games and RPGs, is I know I just said have a silent house, but whatever, I'm about to lie. Get like a Spotify playlist or just buy some albums on the iTunes, but get really good iconic spooky music. The best soundtrack I've ever heard for just random shenanigans going on in horror is Francis Ford Coppola's
Dracula. Same thing. No
yeah,
joke.
Cut that Annie. Is it Annie Lennox who does the last song on it? I don't know. Whatever. That last song, it's a fine song. It just really throws off the mood. But that whole soundtrack, it's got the creepy Victorian vibe.
Start to finish.
Yeah. Oh, it's so good. And the Vampire Hunters theme is one of the best bits of music I've ever heard. I ran a really long Ravenloft campaign, actually, and I set it to that music. And it was really funny. I don't know if I was doing it subconsciously or if it's just we noticed it when we noticed it, but it seemed like that soundtrack cues itself up very well for things. And so when bad stuff starts happening, if you kind of like listen to the music, there's always like kind of a bad tilt to the music just flaring up right when you're starting to pay attention to it. It's perfect. It's awesome. As an alternative, Eric Kunzel and the Cincinnati Pops Orchestra have an album which is on iTunes called Scary Music. But it has the end theme from Sleepy Hollow, This is Halloween from Nightmare Before Christmas, Beetlejuice, Addams Family, The Exorcist, Ghostbusters, The Munsters, Tales from the Crypt. And this is the Cincinnati Pops Orchestra, so it's all instrumental, so you don't have any of that annoying singing to like start rattling around in your brain while you're trying to think about the game you're playing. It's just the music. And since it's from horror movies that you've probably heard of or watched, it just colors everything. And so if you get a particularly creepy, like when The Exorcist starts playing, and if The Exorcist freaks you out, like it should, because,
you know, the movie holds up in its creepiness too. No joke.
Yeah, it just seeps into you. And humans like telling stories, and you relate things. And so you start listening to this music, and it just brings all that out of you. And even if it's just below the surface, and you're just kind of thinking about how creepy that movie is, it just kind of colors everything with a creepy vibe. So yeah, I'm a big fan of actually borrowing soundtracks for those things, because it movies that have a really good mood and have really obvious song cues can really bring, if you want that mood to creep into your game, it can really pack a punch if you pick your music right. So
no, that's absolutely good advice. I mean, movie scores in general are always good. Pick a couple of composers that are known for their creepy scores. Danny Elfman comes to mind. Elliot Goldenthal comes to mind. If you've ever seen it, there's a movie called In Dreams that has an absolutely creepy, creepy score. Francis Ford Coppola version of Dracula has one of probably the finest examples, like you said. That soundtrack could pretty much be the theme to any of the games that we're going to be talking about tonight. All right, so you set the mood.
You set the
music.
That's
now
right.
Let's talk about what games we're going to set up on the table. And let's start with some really fantastic RPGs.
So some of these are more along the lines of you want to start a campaign of them on Halloween. And some of these work really well for one shots. So I'll try to call it out as that pops up. First one on our list is the one I've been playing most recently. And it does both. You can run a very good one shot of it, or you can run a whole campaign. But it's Knights Black Agents, which, if you've heard us talk about the Dracula dossier, Knights Black Agents is the RPG that the Dracula dossier goes with.
Yes.
And it's
a
gumshoe game.
Great, great, great little system too, because you and I have sat down for a couple of real short one-offs with it, and it's always been fun.
It's a great game. It's gumshoe, so it's if you like gumshoe, you'll like it. And it's spies versus vampires, and you can't go wrong. It's action movie stuff, but you get to stake people in the heart. It's awesome.
Yeah, but, I mean, just to kind of set the tone here, this is definitely more in line with Blade than with, say, Dracula.
Or actually, the best Knights Black Agents TV show I've ever seen is, there's a show, it's on Hulu right now, I think, but it's called Ultraviolet, which was a 6-episode series, which should have gone on longer because it doesn't really end well. But it's about a spy agency in the UK that's fighting vampires. And the fun part is they never say the word vampire in the entirety of the series, but it's totally vampires. It's obvious. They just call them leeches for the most part. But it's got a surprisingly good cast. The show's kind of old, so it's got a lot of British actors that went on to do much better things. It's got Idris Elba as one of the lead detectives or lead agents of this this agency. The fun part was the guy who plays a vampire Bill in True Blood, Stephen Moyer, he's in it, and no less, he's a vampire, which was really funny.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's a really good show, and it's super spies versus vampires. It's this, you know, government agency trying to figure out A, what vampires are up to, and B, how to stop them, and it's a really good show. It was made in 1998. It's a little dated. The hairstyles are kind of funny. There's a lot of pastels. Definitely check it out. It's a good show.
Now, this next one is actually one that I'm starting a campaign in right now, and that is the Carrion Crown setting of Pathfinder. So it's a completely horror-based setting for the Pathfinder universe.
Basically, the Pathfinder world has a bunch of countries, and this is the gothic horror Ravenloft country. It's the Ravenloft, it's the dark fantasy, it's the vampires and werewolves and stuff area of this world, Europe area.
It's a perfect place for the Inquisitor or Witch or Summoner class to play.
Exactly. And I've actually read this adventure series. I almost pulled the trigger and bought all of them, but it went out of print and I couldn't get them all physically, which made me very sad.
Well, as I am about to be a player of it, I'll be giving everybody updates as our campaign goes forward.
I've read both good and bad reviews of it, so I'm curious where you're going to fall on that.
So now you compared this to a D&D property, which is actually next on our list.
Curse of Strahd's the campaign. If you want to run a one-shot, the first edition module, just Castle Ravenloft, is a very good option. So basically, Curse of Strahd, like I said, is the campaign. It takes you from level 1 to level 10. The last tail end of the campaign where you go into the Castle Ravenloft, is for the most part the 5th edition conversion of the original module. They just added a lot of stuff in the front of it to give it a more cohesive story. But yeah, if you want to just jump straight into the castle and make up, I think you're supposed to go in there at 7th level, just make up some 7th level characters and go do a one shot, you know, storm in Dracula's castle for all intents and purposes. That's certainly something you can do. So yeah, you can either start off a campaign or you can just storm the evil vampire's castle. Either way, it's a good time. The original adventure, there's a reason they've remade that adventure like 5 times.
Now next up on our list is something that you and I talked a lot lot about last year because it hit Kickstarter in a very, very big way, and that is Delta Green and Call of Cthulhu.
Both of these have been on Kickstarter recently for Call of Cthulhu 7th Edition, which I think is just coming out for retail, and Delta Green, the role-playing game, which is also just coming out for retail. Delta Green is, for all intents and purposes, Call of Cthulhu in the modern day. Either one will do good. Call of Cthulhu has a bunch of one-shot adventures that you can play in one night and have a perfectly creepy time. They are famous for it. I mean, they've got long campaigns too. There's the classic, The Masks of Narothotep, I can't pronounce that word today. But yeah, there's a lot of long-form campaigns. There's a lot of one-shots they have. Either way, you're going to be good. So far, the Delta Green RPG has a lot of shorter adventures. All of them are really messed up. So messed up.
And that, of course, is a series that is more in line with, say, something like X-Files.
Yeah. It's the modern day. You're agents working for a shadowy government organization full of top men who you're doing things for, and you're not exactly sure why, and you're giving stuff back to them, and you're not exactly sure what they're doing with it. So, yeah, very conspiracy, very, very fun. The intro product, which teaches you how to play, called Delta Green Need to Know, it's free on DriveThruRPG. Why not? You know, go get it. Run a one-shot of it today. When you're listening,
you really
to this.
Can't beat that price.
Yeah, exactly. Also, as an alternative, the Gumshoe version, Trail of Cthulhu, also the same thing. A lot of short adventures, a lot of long ones. A really good book for Halloween is a book called Shadows Over Filmland, which I think it's 13 scenarios, but they're all based off of Universal monster movies, you know, like Frankenstein, Dracula, and nice. Some of those movies have actually entered the public domain, like the Bela Lugosi movie White Zombie has entered the public domain. So there's an adventure in there called Black Zombie, and it is a direct sequel to the movie.
Very nice.
It's really cool. And you can link them together to form a cohesive campaign where you're just running around fighting, you know, Cthulhu versions of vampires and werewolves. And it's a little bit more of a silly campaign because it's based off of, you know, the older Universal monster movies and playing with those tropes more than Cthulhu tropes a little bit. But they're awesome adventures. Or you can play, you know, Eternal Lies or Armitage Files. There's a ton of really good adventures for Trail of Cthulhu as well. So Cthulhu role-playing games, it's hard to go wrong with them, to be honest with you. Just pick one.
Next on our list is something that I really, really like, and it's the End of the World RPG system. And this is an RPG system that is split into four books, but is the exact same system in the first half of every single one of these books. And then each book gives you a series of campaign settings, and this is a neat system because you basically sit down at the table, you're handed a character sheet, you fill it out as yourself, and the moment the game starts, that's when the world ends. And you have to figure out a way out, starting at your gaming table and then walking your way through the campaign from there. And there's four primary settings that have been released. There's the Revolt of the Machines, which think Terminator. There's the Alien Invader, and that is more along the lines of, say, War of the Worlds. You've got Zombie Apocalypse, which I think speaks for itself. And then finally, Wrath of the Gods, which is, think Ragnarok.
Yeah, just any gods run amok.
And this is,
they have several examples in there, including Cthulhu.
This is a super narrative, super lean down system. It's really easy to get into, and it's going to make for a perfect one-shot evening campaign.
Next up is the classic Jenga game called Dread, which is every time your character does anything, you get to pull a tile off of the Jenga tower.
And we do mean an actual Jenga tower, as in Jenga, the game that you can get for $10 at Walmart.
Yeah, if the Jenga tower falls, you die. You're out of the game for the rest of the night.
Yeah.
And you can purposely knock over the tower to do something awesome, but your character will die.
The Jenga tower basically represents your sanity. And every time you do something that is going to force you to make a tough choice, your sanity is kind of eroding, and the GM will tell you to remove one of those Jenga pieces.
And sometimes more than one if you're doing something particularly awesome.
Next up is the Dresden Files. And if you're familiar with this series of books, then this is pretty self-explanatory. Harry Dresden's a wizard, and all of the things that go bump in the night that you've been told about actually do exist. And he kind of battles and keeps them in check in Chicago. And Dresden Files is kind of a neat RPG system. It's really built for long-term campaigns. There's an entire book dedicated, and this is not a small book, this is about a 300 or 400 page book, and it's just dedicated to world creation. It's a neat, neat system that I highly suggest, and it's perfect for both shorter and longer campaigns, but really lends itself well to some spectacularly long campaigns.
Now, this next one I'm not familiar with, which is odd.
Yeah, this is actually a Kickstarter that I backed last year, and it's called Shadows Over Seoul. And if you're familiar with the game Dead Space or the movie Event Horizon, that kind of gives you an idea. It's future science fiction-based. Something's gone terribly, terribly wrong in either a spaceship or space station, and you're all alone, and you're exploring it, and mayhem ensues.
Sounds right up my alley. The Alien movie is the best piece of film ever. So,
and this is an extremely narrative system. It's extremely rules light, and I've been having a blast reading through all of it.
Have to borrow it.
Yeah. Well, and it's also available on DriveThruRPG should you want to pick up a copy. And there is a ton of supplementary material from pre-gen characters to campaigns available. And I've been having a great time with it.
Last but not least, run a very Halloween episode of your ongoing campaign. And it does not matter if you're at a point in the narrative or whatever where running something Halloween inspired will be like a record scratch on the flow. Just do it anyway because it's awesome.
Yeah, you can always write it off as a dream.
Right, right. When I was running my Star Wars RPG, my players were on Tatooine, and I decided to run a Halloween episode, mainly at their request. They're like, we have to have a Halloween episode. I'm like, you're on Tatooine. Like, what are you going to do? And what I ended up doing was I basically had a Jabba's Palace that somebody got kidnapped, and they got taken to the Jabba's Palace by them. And so the players went in there, and they searched the place, got all the way to the bottom, and they were being really, really quiet. And I was just waiting for one of them to fail a stealth check, and they did it the most appropriate place, which is at the bottom of the place, you know, as far from the front door as they could get. And that was when they just got attacked by swarms and swarms of rat ghouls, because why not? I know they're not really on Tatooine or whatever. It doesn't matter. It was the very special Halloween episode, and I didn't care. It was fun.
Hey, you never know what cargo container accidentally got opened, right?
Exactly. So just run it. Just run something horror for no reason. Just even if it is a record scratch, just do it. It'll be fun. Your players will thank you.
Yeah, there's lots of different ways that you can incorporate it into a long-term campaign. Everybody stops for a rest and something spooky happens. It's all happening in somebody's head. You could even maybe tie it to the events of your main campaign in some way, shape, or form. Just be clever and have fun with it.
Moving from RPGs, we go to some good horror board games.
Of which there are a ton to
choose
from. There
are quite a few.
We spoke about it earlier in this episode. Mansions of Madness now has the second edition out. And what's fantastic about the second edition is it all runs off of an app that takes place of the Overlord, which means it has become a truly cooperative game, which is awesome.
I'm really interested in this one, mainly because it has models, and I'm a model guy.
Yeah, Mansions of Madness is a ton of fun. I've played it co-op with a few friends, and I gotta tell you, the app adds so much to it because it has so many of those items that we talked about earlier. It's got great creepy music, people are role-playing in it, and there's good voice acting in it, and honestly, it lends itself really well to role-playing the roles that you're playing, and it's just a ton of fun. I highly suggest Mansions of Madness 2nd Edition. Next up is, in the same vein from the same company, Fantasy Flight Games has quite a few games in the Arkham universe, and the next one is a classic by Kevin Wilson called Arkham Horror.
AKA the game where you beat your head against a wall and hopefully push your way through.
Yeah, so let me qualify this game first. Number one, you're gonna need some time to play it, at least 3 to 6 hours. Number two, be prepared, because this game is hard. And I'm not talking about difficult hard, I'm talking about brutal, soul-crushing, why did I even bother trying this hard?
So Nintendo hard.
Yeah, Nintendo 8-bit. Ninja Gaiden hard. That kind of hard.
And not one. No. Ninja Gaiden 3. You only get 3 continues. Not unlimited.
Now that said, I will also say this about it. This game is infinitely rewarding when you do succeed at it, because you really truly feel like you've accomplished something. And that's kind of a neat feeling. Now, in that same universe, they also have a property called Elder Signs, and this is also a Kevin Wilson game, I believe. And in Elder Signs, you play the roles of investigators that are researching the university. You do this by rolling dice, trying to find specific types of clues to prevent the Elder Ones from coming into the universe.
Wait, university? Are you doing it at Miskatonic University?
Maybe.
Nice. I have a sweatshirt that has an unironic Miskatonic University logo on it, and when I wear that, I just roll that's where I went to college, and I talk about it like it's real.
That's awesome.
And it's really funny, because there is enough about Miskatonic University between the role-playing game and the books and all that you can have enough random facts about it that it sounds like you actually went there, and it really messes with people. It's quite fun. I recommend it. There's a ton of, unironic Miskatonic University sweaters are the best.
The last game in that universe that we talked about from Fantasy Flight is, of course, Eldritch Horror, And Eldritch Horror is basically Arkham Horror, except with a streamlined rule set and meant to kind of fix some of the things that people didn't like about Arkham. There's still fan bases for both. I'm not going to say that one is better than the other, but I will say that they offer some vastly different experiences, one being super crunchy and super long, and the other one being quite a bit more streamlined and definitely not nearly as browbeatingly challenging.
That sounds more up my alley. I played Arkham Horror quite a bit. I played like 7 games of it, and we only won once, and we were cheating.
That sounds about right. Arkham Horror is brutal.
Yeah.
For something a little less brutal, there's a fun little co-op game out there. It's not particularly deep, but it works as a co-op experience, especially if you're trying to get non-gamers into the hobby. And that is based on the Ghostbusters universe, and that's Ghostbusters the board game.
So yeah, that one's by Cryptozoic, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes,
and it's based off of the comic art, if I'm not mistaken.
It is based off of the comic art, but it borrows heavily from the movies as well. They had some restrictions from a licensing perspective, but I think they've done a really good job of kind of sneaking some of the core elements of the movie in. And it does come with one of the coolest minis ever. There is a giant State Puff marshmallow mini.
And Ecto-1, if I'm not mistaken.
And there is an Ecto-1. And Ghostbusters 2, the board game, is coming out soon. And that actually comes with a Statue of Liberty that you can use instead of Ecto-1 for moving around the map. So, again, this is a co-op game. It's very, very light. You can teach the rules in under 5 minutes. There's not a whole lot to it. It's barely above a late 80s, early 90s roll and move game, but it's charming, it's easy to teach, and it's good for non-gamers. And so to keep that in mind as something a bit more simple, but still fun. Next is a deck builder that borrows heavily from a game that I play regularly, and that is Star Realms. And this is, of course, Cthulhu Realms, which we've talked about on the show before. Got neat art, super easy to teach, very well-balanced game. That's one of the things that I really appreciate about Cthulhu Realms versus Star Realms. It's much more balanced. Yeah, there's not much else to speak
of. Yeah, Star Realms is frustrating, because I played that with my wife a bunch, and I felt like I was cleaning her clock, like I started feeling bad. And then she beat me once, and she wrecked me. And yeah, that game is very... taken 2 damage and you have taken 50.
Star Realms tends to be very streaky that way. Cthulhu Realms rebalances the cards in such a way that the games tend to be very close, and I've been enjoying it a bit more from a mechanical perspective. Now, next is one of my favorite games, if not perhaps my favorite game, and this is also my favorite edition of the game, and that is Fantasy Flight's Fury of Dracula 3rd Edition. And if you have not picked up a copy yet, I want you to stop what you're doing, go to whatever store and or online outlet that you normally use, and I want you to get yourself a copy of Fury of Dracula 3rd Edition, because it is a Games Workshop title, and that means that Fantasy Flight is losing the license, and this is the penultimate version of the game. There's nothing even remotely close to it in terms of both deductive reasoning, hide-and-go-seek gameplay, and just a streamlined experience that takes a great game and makes it an unstoppable game.
Yeah, I'm really curious what's going to become of this game, because I know Games Workshop is really hitting the streets hard trying to find a new publisher for this. They were at some property convention, where they were trying to license this game out, so...
Well, this third edition is superior in every way to the second edition, and that's not to say that the second edition was a slouch, because
it's hard to imagine anybody doing better than Fantasy Flight. Like, I can't even think of a company where if I heard that they picked it up over Fantasy Flight, I'd be like, oh, okay, it'll be in good hands.
Yeah, I got to tell you, if there's one thing that Fantasy Flight's good at is revisions, too. I mean, just look at Descent 2nd Edition. Just look at Mansions of Madness 2nd Edition. I mean, they've made this into an art form of taking a good idea and making it great.
Next up is a game that you introduced me to called The Others.
Yes, Seven Sins.
So tell us more about that.
Yeah, this is a game from Eric Lang. Of course, he is all the rage these days. He won the Diana Jones Award this year. He, of course, put out Blood Rage last year, which was the hotness of the year. And this is a fun little game with a lot of variation. It borrows some ideas from Zombicide, but it's much, much deeper. And what's neat is there is variation in the heroes, there's variations in the enemies, there's variation in the primary puppet master, if you will, from the enemy standpoint. And that means that every time you play, you can start changing some of these variables up, making it feel fresh and new every single time.
So next up on the list is something I've actually played, and you actually introduced me to it, Mysterium.
Yeah.
The game, psychic stuff. Talking to spirits.
This is a really neat game for that dark room and candlelight.
Oh, yeah, that'd be great.
And one of the best parts about Mysterium is that in the instruction book is a little QR code, and if you click on it, it will take you to an infinitely looping soundtrack, which is so good.
That's awesome.
And it's perfect for the game, too.
So in this game, the players are psychics, and one person has to be like a game master player or the odd guy out. And he is playing a ghost who has, well, he's playing a lot of ghosts, actually, that have been murdered in various ways. And you are trying to figure out how the ghost that you are communicating with was murdered, kind of like Clue style. It's like who did it, where, with what weapon type deal. But all they have to show you is these, they get randomly pictures on a, from a deck of cards. And every turn, they just have to hand out cards to people. And you got to figure out what the spirit is trying to tell you.
Yeah.
And it's perfect because, like, you can do every bad TV psychic trope there is. It's like, oh, the spirits are speaking to me. And I'm seeing a vision of a suit of armor. And yeah, just trying to interpret visions and stuff. Oh, it was so clever. It was so much fun.
I played this game with groups of folks that are not board gamers. And let me tell you, it's been successful every single time. This is one of those games that is easy to draw non-gamers into because it's very easy to explain. And it doesn't involve dice rolling or anything like that. So there, people seem to really just kind of naturally gravitate towards it.
I could see that. It's simple, easy. It's yeah.
And
easy
it's super fun, though. It's super, yeah. super fun.
It's kind of in the weird vein of like Cards Against Humanity. Or apples to apples or whatever, where if you've been playing with a crowd for a while, you kind of do get like a vocabulary going.
Yes.
And yeah, just having that, but then every so often throwing a couple new people in who don't know what you guys are talking about, it really shakes things up. I don't know, it's a great game. Check it out.
We talked about Ravenloft in the RPG section, and we can actually talk about it here in the board game section as well, because there is a Dungeons & Dragons board game called Castle Ravenloft.
This was the first of the four dungeon board games that Wizards produced. I've heard it's not the best version, but it's Ravenloft. There's vampires and undead dragons. So it's one of those adventure games where you're running around in a dungeon, fighting monsters, kind of like Descent, kind of like Super Dungeon Explorer. There's a lot of games like this. What I like about it is there is no dungeon master player. There's no person who has to control all the monsters. You're actually, all of you are playing cooperatively against a board itself, which is a lot of fun. And it has a bunch of components. It has a bunch of miniatures. You explore a dungeon. You assemble it. There's different scenarios in the book. And online, there's people who've made scenarios too. So once you get done with this game, you can go find some stuff online. And a lot of times people use components out of all four of the board games and mash them together to make like a super board game. And yeah, it's a lot of fun for your D&D monster slaying. And it's based off of the fourth edition mechanics, which I don't think we've ever talked about fourth edition and why I love and hate that game. But it works much better. A little bit here and there. It works very well as a board game. Because they strip it down, they make it a lot easier. Most monsters only have one wound, so if you hit them, they just die. You don't have to like track hit points and a lot of the fiddly stuff that 4th edition kind of was bad at. But a lot of the fun mechanics of board control and dynamic battles are in the board game, which I liked. I mean, I don't know. It works very well as a board game, not so much as a role-playing game. So check it out, Castle Ravenloft or Wrath of Ashardalon or Icewind Dale or the Temple of Elemental Evil. But Ravenloft is the Halloween one, so that's the one we're going to tell you to get in the Halloween segment.
Now, next up are a couple of games from Flying Frog Productions, and these guys are known for some very, very Ameritrash games, and I say that with absolute love and affection. They tend to be a little bit on the lighter side, but they sure are fun, especially with groups. And that is A Touch of Evil and Last Night on Earth. And these are, Last Night on Earth is a zombie survival game, and A Touch of Evil is a murder survival game.
The themes are different. Touch of Evil has this, like, colonial horror vibe going on, so think like the movie Sleepy Hollow.
Yes.
Last Night on Earth and Invasion from Outer Space actually use the same rule set, and they're interchangeable. So Last Night on Earth is high school students and zombies. Invasion from Outer Space is circus performers, including a dancing bear, and aliens. And you can flip-flop them. You know, you can have the aliens fight the high school kids. You could have the circus people fighting zombies. It doesn't matter. Both games are great, so check them out.
Yeah, they're silly. They're light. They're very tongue-in-cheek, but they are, at the end of the day, very, very fun games. So next up is a series that really doesn't need a whole lot of introduction. Everybody's at least seen it on the store shelf and knows what it's about. And that is the Zombicide series. And really, it doesn't matter which one of the Zombicides you choose. There's several seasons available for the first generation, which is the modern Zombicide. And that is playing the original Zombicide, which takes place in a city. There's a prison expansion, kind of similar to season 2 of The Walking Dead and year 2 of The Walking Dead in the comics. There's also a Rue de Morgue expansion, which kind of takes place in Louisiana, and there's several other mini expansions, lots of different ways to add more zombies to your game. And most importantly, last year was the release of Zombicide Black Plague, which took the whole thing into the fantasy realm with wizards and elves and dwarves, etc., and took the rule set, really streamlined it even more, and made some really smart changes, especially around like firing a weapon into a crowd with a friendly in it, and just kind of generally just made the rules in a way kind of perfect for Zombicide. And just it's a fun co-op game that just really is always a blast to take out.
I've played this game a ton. The first one, I haven't actually played any of the sequels, but it's a very solid game. You just go around and murder zombies and try to beat the board, which is hard.
Yeah, the game can be very, very difficult, but in a really good way.
Yeah, and you get a sense of accomplishment when you finish it up. So on the off chance you've never heard of this game, go check it out. And last but not least, we have the classic Betrayal at the House on the Hill, which is one of my favorite board games. It is a very, very light board game. And what's fun about it is you play a group of middling kids, for the most part, who are investigating a haunted house. And then as you go through the haunted house, you discover, among other things, these things called omens. And omens are a random deck of cards that can be generated in rooms. And every time you find an omen, you roll a test. And you're trying to roll lower than the amount of omens that are currently on the board. So if there's one omen on the board, you have to roll higher than one. And then what omen you found and in what room, you get a randomized ending, some of which are obviously based on horror movies. Like there's this one where if you find a mask in a specific room, basically Jason Voorhees comes and starts murdering his way through the house. Some of them are a little bit more weird. In one of them, a giant bird comes and picks up the house, and there are amount of parachutes in the house equal to the number of players divided by two, rounded up. The goal of it is to get a parachute and jump out and not die. One of them is very inspired by The Thing, where there's an alien virus that's taking over people, and that one's very clever. Basically, everybody gets two virus tokens, and randomly, but one of them has the number one on it, and the other ones just have random numbers of because there's a lot of tokens in the game. And every time you encounter another player, you trade a token at random. And if you ever get the number one, guess what? You have the virus now and you're trying to kill or you're trying to convert everybody else. Even if you lose the number one token, you've still already been converted. It's a great game. They just came out with the first expansion for the game called Widow's Walk, which
How long did that take? I mean, why did it take that many years for the expansion to come out?
I don't know, but it was a long time coming.
Yeah, and the Widow's Walk expansion adds, what, 50 new stories to it?
Yeah, something crazy. It adds the roof of the house, like a completely new section.
Yeah, a whole other level, exactly.
And it adds in more endings, and yeah, it's great. It's a great game. It is not a deep game. Once you learn it, you will get it done in 15 to 45 minutes, depending.
Yeah, but there's such variation in the game. You shuffle the tiles, you have the different adventures, you know. It's one of those games where every time you play it, it's going to feel like a new experience just because nothing will ever be the same.
Because there's literally, I think there's 13 omens and there's 13 rooms you can find them in. So, and I believe there's the 13 times 13 endings. I think there's some overlap, but there's a lot. There's a lot. And with the expansion, there's more.
Yeah, it's a huge amount of variation. This is a game that just keeps on giving, and it's really an inexpensive game for that.
Yeah, and it's funny how I've played this game so many times. I've played this game at least 50 times, and I've not gotten that many repeats. I've had the bird one twice. I've had this like creepy doll one a couple times, but there's some that I've still only ever seen once. One of the complaints is some of the endings are very, very hard to win if you are the surviving humans and easy for the bad guy. Oh, that's the thing too. Some of the endings, one of the players randomly turns into the bad guy and you get separate victory conditions where I was playing Jason Voorhees in that one. And my win condition was murder everybody in the house. And every time you killed Jason, he just came back at the beginning of the next turn with one higher in all of his stats and a new machete ready to murder some more. And then the goal of the other people was to assemble some stuff to kill Jason, or do they? It's not Jason Voorhees, it's the mask killer, but it's so Jason Voorhees. It's a fantastic game, and it's one of those really great games that if somebody just likes horror movies, you can probably get them to play this game. It's fantastic.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a really easy one to get new gamers into. And one last title that we can talk about is, you know, relatively new, but definitely also a hugely popular title, and that is Dead of Winter.
Yeah, I can't believe we almost forgot that one.
Yeah, I know, right? And Dead of Winter, of course, just came out with its first, it's a standalone expansion that you can purchase and play on its own, just like Dead of Winter, or you can combine Dead of Winter and Dead of Winter Last Night together into a super Dead of Winter game. But it's basically taking The Walking Dead show and making it into a challenging strategy game where you have to forage and defend yourself from zombies simultaneously. And the game has a really interesting traitor mechanic where you have a 1 in 6 chance of having a traitor in your game. So you're never 100% sure if you even have one in your game, let alone who that person might be. I really, really like Dead of Winter.
I have sadly still never played this game. I've seen it played a couple times, and it looks great, but I've never done it.
We shall have to fix that, because I think you'd like it a lot. Dead of Winter is, you know, depending on whether or not you use the traitor mechanic, it's a co-op to semi-cooperative game, and it's just a ton of fun.
Add that to the list, my man. Wait. What's its baby rating?
That is definitely a front pack game.
Ooh, excellent.
That brings us to the end of yet another episode of the Forgot My Dice podcast. It has been an absolute pleasure to share this time with you. As always, hit us up on all of our digital outlets. We'd love to hear from you, and we'd love to get your feedback. Looking at ForgotMyDice.com, of course, we're going to continue to try and bring you some of the best content on the web for all role-playing games and board games. And we do have a review of the 3 volumes of the Star Wars role-playing game from Fantasy Flight Games upcoming in the near future, so be looking for that.
We're working on it. We're trying to get it together. It's been rough with the twins.
It'll,
you know what,
my first written piece on the site, which I'm really excited about.
Yeah, very, very cool. And you want to know what, I actually got some time yesterday because the babies were attacking the wife, but not me. I wrote a first draft of a review for Adventures in Middle Earth, the 5th edition Middle Earth RPG. So
fantastic,
yay, stuff on the site.
So look at those and much, much more coming up soon. And beyond that, I think that brings us to the end of the episode, Robert. As usual, keep gaming, and we'd love to hear what you guys have on the table. Share it with us on all of our digital profiles.
As always, be excellent to one another.
And party on.
The music you heard in this podcast was Intro by Elephio and Retro Funk by Persephone, both used with permission via the Creative Commons license.